Hello and welcome back to the Cardboard Herald, my chance to talk with creative gamers and game creators. And today I am joined by Greg Loring, the Lore Master Albright. Welcome to the show, Greg.
Thanks for having me and for giving me what hopefully is a new nickname.
Yeah, you know, we're going to establish that and it's going to stick. I have a feeling that before long we're going to have Lore Master Games, we're going to have Lore Master Studios. It is going to be the thing. For those of you who weren't listening before I even started recording, I was having a lot of trouble with getting the pronunciation of the first of two last names appropriately pronounced there. It's a hyphenated name, right?
That's right. Yep. Both my spouse and I are married and we hyphenated our last names.
Oh, that's a cool way to go. I have a set of friends that did that and I was like, man, that is a cool approach. He nearly just fully committed and converted to her last name because he was like, you know what, I don't really want to associate with my family, but she convinced him that it was worth it to fully integrate. So did each of you get to keep like the first part of your last name as your original name pre-marriage, or do you guys commit to one of your last names came first?
No, yeah, we have my legal last name is Albright and my partner's last name is Loring. But we just felt that Loring Albright flows better than Albright Loring, so we were like, great, we'll do it that way.
Yeah, and that also means that your partner is the original lore master, and you are like the usurper.
That's right.
In this. Interesting.
That's right. I married into the lore.
Lucky you. Lucky you.
That's right.
All right. Well, for you folks listening, this is a really cool opportunity for me because if you've been following the Cardboard Herald, you've been reading our reviews, you've listened to TCBH reviews, you know that I've been kind of on the fence about some of the tabletop puzzle games, you know, narrative puzzle mysteries. And then I played the Tale of Ord by Post Curious, and that kind of blew my mind. It legitimized this new type of tabletop gaming that I was kind of wrestling with. Not that I didn't enjoy it, but it felt like it was a proof of concept initially rather than a legitimate new genre demanding exploration. And I've also talked about escape rooms in the past as kind of like, you know, another thing that I really dig, but still kind of wrestling with, like, what is the format going forward on this? And Greg and I met up on the internet, and it turns out he makes pervasive games, and that just blew my mind. So before we get any further, Greg, can you explain what the heck you're talking about when you say, I make pervasive games?
Yeah, totally. I've had some good practice with this recently.
Yeah, so I bet.
I can get a succinct definition.
We don't do succinct around here. No succinct. Oh, you can take as much time and have as much rambling as possible. If people have put up with me for this amount of time, then they're bound to allow you for as much time as you need.
You may come to regret having said this. nonetheless, pervasive games are... So this is like very reductive, but they're games. So anything that a game is, they are, that are pervasive. So by pervasive, we mean like kind of like expanding and pervading and sort of taking over either space or time.
Uh-huh.
And a really great example that kind of brings this home is something like Pokemon Go, where it's pervasive in space, right? It's not just in one place. I can go anywhere and find a gym or a Pokestop. And it's pervasive in time. Just because I am not playing right now doesn't mean that the game isn't ongoing. Other people can be playing when I'm not playing.
Mm-hmm.
The pervasive games I make don't have a digital component because I'm bad at computers. so that's where the Pokemon Go analogy falls apart. But I found that that's a really good touch point for some of the characteristics of pervasive games, that they can take over space and they can take over time. Sometimes they do just one or the other, sometimes they do both.
So how about an example of something that you've done in the past, and then we'll kind of tie that back to what this current project, the Carnival de Resistance that's going on in Philly, is.
Yeah, totally. So one of my favorite examples of a pervasive game that I've worked on was with my friend Andy Patton in Chicago with his company Waxwing Puzzle Company. We made a game called Heist in the Museum of the Art Institute of Chicago, where players were art thieves trying to steal art. And so to steal art, you had to take a picture of like part of a painting and text it to someone on the other team, and they had to figure out where that painting was and take a picture of the full picture and text it back to you. Mm. And then we had some movement rules for getting around the galleries, and then you had to escape once you stole your painting. The catch with all of this was that we didn't tell the museum that we were playing this game.
Okay. All right. I like it already.
So it was great.
Yeah.
Yeah, and we.
You're like the Banksy of gaming. I like it.
You just keep making all these high-flying comparisons, and I'm like, I don't know if I can live up to it. But
well, actually, I was just thinking about what if someone was an actual art thief and they were using the guise of pretending to be an art thief in order to get away with it, and they, you know, were able to inspect around a museum and look super suspicious, and then they'd just be like, oh, he's playing that art thief game, when in truth they were actually casing the joint. But if you didn't tell the museum that you were conducting this game, then, you know, I guess that theory falls apart. What was their reaction?
I don't know if they found out.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
Nice.
We didn't run a lot of the things that Waxwing did and still does, and that I do, are multiple iterations that happen again and again. But this one, we built it as a playtest. We had a pretty active playtesting community, and we could get people to come out to things. So we built this as a playtest, but it was pretty much a finished game. We didn't have to tweak much. And we ran it once, and we all had like such an adrenaline high. And we said, you know what? We're going to get kicked out of the museum if we try and do this again. And banned for life. So let's just call it that. Let's call it a day.
I don't know. So you could put that on a resume for certain types of work. That would be pretty cool.
That's right. Well, it's on my resume now, so.
Okay, so now we have the current project that you are just one artist or designer, or what's your actual title and relationship to Carnival de Resistance, which, of course, I'm going to pronounce it that way every time, even if that's not how it's pronounced. That's what it is to me.
That's how the organizers pronounce it, and that's how I pronounce it, so.
Okay,
you're
great.
Right, as far as I know. I've talked to people who sort of stumble over or don't want to commit to the full sort of, like, Frenchization of it, but
I
love it. I think it's a goofy time. Carnival is all about upending and changing power relations and doing things you're not comfortable with, so I say go for it. Say it goofy. Carnival de Resistance. So my role in the Carnival is... I'm making a pervasive game. So the Carnival is this ongoing, I think this is its seventh or eighth year, residency. It's happened to different cities across the country, and there's a Carnival Midway, and then there are performances. And so the Carnival Midway is where I'm doing my work. You know, there are magicians and little like carnival game stalls with, you know, spin the wheel and knock the milk jugs down with a ball and all that stuff. And, all of it is towards this sort of like goal of engaging people in stories of resistance through history and stories of art and activism. So they all have this sort of didactic component. And my work is to connect all of these carnival characters and these games through this sort of overarching mega game structure. Mega game's the wrong term, because it's not a mega game like Watch the Skies or something, but it's a thing that happens throughout the carnival that no matter what you're doing, you could also be playing my game. So you'll meet a character, they'll say, oh, I have a quest for you. Can you go and find this thing? Or can you take this message to this person? And all these sort of interactions between these carnival characters who in previous iterations of the carnival existed and had stories, now they have stories that are like a little bit a layer deeper, that if you are playing the game, you can sort of learn more about who these characters are and how they relate to each other.
So now I'm hoping that every resident of Philly who listens to this doesn't start just assigning random quests to people walking around the streets. That might get a little crazy, but at the same time, the temptation is there. I know that's something
that's like it's like the most pervasive. Just every game is just spilling out of every person in the city.
Yeah, well, there's like two things I've always wanted to do in my life. One of them is to be the quest giver, because I'm a big RPG guy, like video game RPG, and, you know, I want to be the person who's like, warriors, heed my call. I need you to blah, 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 blah. And then the second thing is that I want to, in earnest, someday tell someone, you will rue the day. You know, I don't care what, it's over. You know, you will rue the day that you served me peas instead of corn. But in earnest, to have that opportunity, to have that come out. And it sounds like This may have been my opportunity if only I were in Philly rather than Alaska. But I digress. You know,
I mean, the carnival moves. You know, we can submit Juneau as a possible future residency site.
Petition it. Yeah, totally. Well, you know, Juneau, we got 35,000, you know, for a capital city. We're pretty tiny, so I don't think it's coming to here anytime soon. It actually sounds like something that would be well suited for like Ren fairs and that kind of stuff, particularly in big cities. But, you know, aside from giving quests, and surely you don't want to give away too much of what's happening, but how does this actually work? Say I'm someone in Philly right now and I want to participate in this game. Do I sign up somewhere? How do I know when someone's actually interacting with me on the level of the game itself? And then what does that look like as I try to pursue whatever the objectives of the game are?
Yeah, totally. So this isn't as time pervasive as some games. This isn't like an ARG, an alternate reality game, on the model of something like I Love Bees or The Beast, where the game is sort of always going on. The scope of the game is limited to the Carnival Midway, which is it's a few performances. So the last weekend of July, the 27th and the 28th, that Friday and Saturday night, and the first weekend of August, the 3rd and 4th. Starting at 5 o'clock, the Midway opens. And so on any of those days, you know, the two Fridays, the 27th or the 3rd, or the two Saturdays, the 28th or the 4th, you can come to Arch Street United Methodist. It's right downtown, and just walk in, and I'll be there. My role is sort of the quest giver, like you were saying, and I'll be one of the first people you see when you come in the door, and
the lore master.
I'll give you a piece of paper. That's right. That's right. Yep. Giving everyone the Albright lore. So that's how you play is show up. It's not, I like ARGs and I like the idea of something more time pervasive, and I have worked on stuff like that, but, this is not that. This is sorry if you're not going to be in Philly this summer. It's not going to happen for you.
Yeah, I know. Year. I'm
maybe
jealous.
Soon.
I'm jealous. I went to Philly for the first time last year to go to PAX Unplugged, and I absolutely fell in love with the city. I got an Airbnb in downtown, and it was incredible. The food, the people, me and a couple buddies just walked everywhere. I ate so many like egg sandwiches, like egg and sausage sandwiches from like this little cart that was, oh, man, dude, it was amazing. And that sounds like such a cool environment for this to happen. And so I'm totally jealous, but maybe next year,
That's right.
How'd you get
wrapped
up?
Are you coming to PAX?
Oh, well, okay, I'll answer your question. Am I going to PAX Unplugged? This is something I'm actually struggling with. So, not yet. I've had a couple of people ask me, both other companies that I've worked with doing interviews or reviews of in the past that I've established good relationships with, or some people that I met and became friends with there last year. But at the same time, I think I'm only going to get to do one convention toward the end of the year, and I have to judge, is it going to be that? Is it going to be BGG Con or some dark horse contender? But this is actually like my 10-year wedding anniversary is coming up here right around the corner. So I got to kind of carve out time for that. And then it's like, what other time can I afford before the end of the year between 10-year wedding anniversary and Christmas? So
for
we'll
sure.
see. I think so. If I can, you know, if they're, well, I probably shouldn't be soliciting people over the internet to be like, hey, you want to bunk up at a Airbnb for PAX? But, you know, if I find the means to get there, it's a long trip from Alaska, but
That's for sure.
I couldn't imagine a more fun place to visit again. So we'll see.
I feel very spoiled that PAX Unplugged sprang up in my backyard because, as a graduate student, I don't have a lot of spare income to travel to Gen Con and BGG Con and all this. And I was like, well, I'm going to have to make my way in the tabletop world without cons. And then PAX Unplugged sprung up. And I was like, great, I've got at least one a year. It's a 15-minute subway ride from my house to the con. So
you mean you're not traveling up to Juneau, Alaska for Platypus Con? Come on, man. We need pervasive games up here, too.
I'll see if they can,
yeah,
get a plane ticket.
I'll see if they can sponsor you. I'm friends with some of the board. You know what? Get your trip up to Alaska. It's going to be kind of the beginning of the year, but you'll get the full Alaskan experience. It'll be great. But back to that question. How'd you get wrapped up in this? Is this something that you were just making weird in life pervasive games your entire life, or did you stumble into this? What's the origin story?
Yeah, it's kind of both. Growing up as a kid, my dad would always make treasure hunts for us, and like, you know, clue hunts where go to one place and find a clue and it guides you to the next place. And I would then end up trying to mimic them myself as a kid, or like I have a lot of cousins and I would make treasure hunts for my cousins growing up. And so it's a thing I've been doing for a long time. I haven't been thinking seriously about it that long, obviously, because who thinks seriously about many things as a kid? I guess that's not true. I remember being a serious kid. Anyway, in 2013, I met Andy Patton, who runs Waxwing in Chicago. We had a friend of a friend, we had a mutual friend in common. We both liked tabletop games. And they were like, you guys should hang out. And so I was like, hey, let's get coffee. And he emailed me back and he said, how about instead of getting coffee, I'm scouting a custom scavenger hunt I'm making for someone's bachelor party, and let's walk around downtown Chicago and figure out some cool things to do with these people, and we can talk. So we scouted a kidnapping story in these abandoned train platforms downtown Chicago, and that was how I got to know Andy, and he was like, sure, let's work together. So I kind of got a lot of my design chops from Pervasive Games from him.
I like to imagine you walking around Chicago being like, if I were kidnapping someone, would this be a good spot to hide the person? How would we contact someone for ransom? And someone's overhearing this like, oh my God, what's going on? It's the museum situation all over again.
Yep. And that's very much Andy's MO, just pushing right up on the boundaries and being like, people can ask us if they want to know what we're doing. We'll tell them what we're up to.
So,
but until then, let's just look as sketchy as possible.
Yeah. So is this like, you know, the new high type of thing? You know, you were into tabletop gaming and then Pervasive Games kind of became your life, and it's hard to get the thrill out of gaming in lesser types of games in your mind now? Or is this something that fully exists as an alternative path for gaming and you love it all?
Oh yeah, it's very much the latter. I design, I make, I participate in the tabletop gaming hobby a lot. And it almost feels like the reverse is true, that there are so many interesting things you can do in tabletop that are really hard to actuate in Pervasive Games. Mm-hmm. That I almost sometimes, when I'm just kind of like daydreaming, I will daydream board game designs more than I'll daydream Pervasive Game designs, because, well, there's a lot of reasons, but I like Pervasive Gaming a whole lot too, and it definitely does things that board games can't. So they're both in there floating around.
So when you're daydreaming about games, is there like any examples of really iconic games that you look at that are just like cornerstones for, this is an awesome game? Like, if I could design a game that makes other people feel the way that this game makes me feel, then I've nailed it. Like, I've achieved everything that I want to achieve.
Yeah, that's exactly how I think about it. I don't know if I have an answer to your question, but I've recently started thinking about design from the player experience model. Someone on Twitter, and I wish I could remember who, said, I listen to all these interviews with designers and they always talk about, I start with theme and I start with mechanics, and no one ever says I start with player experience. And there's probably some hyperbole there. I'm sure there are designers who start with player experience.
Right.
But I agree with this person on Twitter. That is not, I don't hear about it as much either.
Right.
But when I think about games, and you know, when I remember back to my greatest times having fun with people playing games, it's an emotional memory. It's not a structural memory, right? I'm not remembering like, yes, I moved my counter 2 times.
Totally.
It was wonderful. I remember the feeling of what I was doing and why moving that counter 2 times felt so great.
Yeah, and that's something that I think is part of the maturing of the hobby. And I'm sure there's tons of designers who have been thinking that way for a long time, as well as a ton of reviewers who have been thinking that way a long time. But that's something that, in my own reviews, which is how I kind of started doing the Cardboard Herald, was thinking about reviews and thinking about how I feel about games. I wanted to explore some of that emotional reaction to games. And I don't know that I always achieve that, but some things I've been thinking about lately, for example, Spirit Island is a real hot game right now.
Oh man, I really want to play that.
Oh, it's so good. But, you know, I was thinking about the arc of empowerment, I think is actually what I called it in the review, is that the game makes you feel like you are on the precipice of turning the tide. In Tolkien terms, it's the U-catastrophe, you know, just everything right. is dark and black and doom is weighing down on you. But if you just push a little bit further, push a little bit harder, you feel like you are empowered to take hold of the situation. And even if you lose, it still maintains that feeling of empowerment. And that's something that I absolutely love. And so I really latched on to Spirit Island, as well as like Terraforming Mars, for example, and a lot of games where I feel like I have that momentum. And it's not specifically engine building. You know, oftentimes I'll talk about things on the internet, you know, Reddit, and it'll be really reductive. Oh, you like engine building games? And it's like, no, not exactly.
Right.
You know, it's whatever game elicits this feeling from me, or has a degree of thematic resonance in everything it does. Another example is like Catacombs is a game that I have not played a dungeon crawl that makes me feel like I'm back to being a little kid playing HeroQuest like I have with Catacombs. And people are like, are you crazy? Gloomhaven is the game. You got to play Gloomhaven. That's the game. That I'm like, no, because that's all, it's all rules. I'm focused on all the rules and everything is overly described. But if I flick a disc that represents an arrow and that arrow bounces off of a obstacle that's in the way and goes off in a different direction, it's not because of a rule, it's not because of a dice roll, it's not because of anything, it's because that orc was hiding behind a structure and my arrow failed to make that perfect shot that I needed to make. And that's thematically incredibly resonant. And that's the kind of stuff that is driving me wild in games these days, is when I'm able to feel powerful and exciting things. And I think that's why I'm kind of turning my mind or my perspective on a lot of these pervasive games and narrative puzzles and new types of gaming experience that weren't really in the mainstream before. I don't know exactly where I was going with that, but
no, I know what you're talking about.
Yeah.
Just this notion that the thing that you're shooting for, or I'll speak for myself only, the thing that I'm shooting for when I'm like, okay, it's time to play a game. I have people, I have space, I have time. What do I want? And what I want is maybe being distilled through these linguistic devices of like, oh, I want to play a deck builder, or oh, I want to play a minis game, or but really what I think is happening at a deeper level, at a, like a pre-linguistic level, is I'm remembering the feelings I had playing these other games and kind of holding them up and saying, totally. Do I want that feeling or that feeling? And then I grab the box, generates that feeling most precisely and most like often.
Yeah, totally. And I think there's so many different feelings that you could chase after. Like, there is a place in my heart for Gloomhaven, but it is not the same place that's occupied by the imaginative play space of HeroQuest as a child, and the true inheritor of that type of feeling is, like, Catacombs. Anyway, you know, like, I don't want to totally focus on me waxing poetically about all of the games of my youth here, or the games that I've been reviewing lately. You know, what else are you doing aside from the Carnival? What other projects are you working on, man?
So I'll answer this question by also tying in what we were just talking about, which is we started this whole discussion by you asking me, like, what is the one game, kind of like, what is your favorite game, which is a hard question to answer.
Yeah,
but,
totally.
As you were talking about Catacombs, I was thinking about a game that does that for me, not that exact same feeling, but that like has that same potent generation of feeling, which is Skull. Do you know this game?
Oh, dude. Yeah. I love Skull.
Right. So I love Skull too. And it's just like, it's, for me, it's just sort of like that pure distillate of that feeling of you look at someone and you look them in the eye and you say, what are you doing? And you don't know. And you have a little bit of information. This is the same kind of thing that I get pigeonholed when I talk about Skull and games like this, because people are like, oh, you love social deduction games. And I hate a lot of social deduction games because there's no information, I think, is the, well, whatever. I'm talking about feelings here. The feeling of, I have some way to guess at what you're doing, but I can't know for sure. And there's a high stakes decision riding on me knowing for sure. And I taught Skull to a bunch of friends of mine, not all of whom are big gamers, and they all got into it and grasped it. And we were going around and it was someone's turn to decide if he wanted to flip cards. And he just sat at the table and he looked at everyone. And then he kind of leaned back in his chair and he went, ah, and my dad is what I want. And yeah. Just like that moment. Perfect.
And it works so well because it's such a simple structure in order to distill that feeling, like you were talking about, the anticipation as you are about to commit to something that you know you can't take it back. As soon as you say a number, you are stuck with that. And it gives you a lot of anxiety, but the relief and the hilarity of failing and the sense of victory when you succeed is incredible. That's such a cool game. Yeah. I love it.
So that's my gateway to answering your question, which is, what am I working on now? Relatively recently, this spring, I finished a Kickstarter for a game that I designed that was published by Pasco Play about Moby Dick called Leviathan.
Uh-huh.
It's going to be a physical product soon, possibly by the end of September, but I can't make promises on that. But that game was sort of, in addition to, because I love Moby Dick and wanted to make a game about it, was my attempt to make that kind of game. It's a game where there's sort of a hidden element. All the whales are face down and the whale player is moving them around the table. It's sort of like a tabletop minis game with cards. And the Ahab player is trying to figure out which whale is Moby Dick and kill it before it kills their whale ship. So all that to say that you have a lot of those moments of, I want to strike, I want to force you to reveal this whale, but if I mess up, I could be sacrificing my chance at winning the game.
Is this going to be available in retail or only to Kickstarter backers?
That is probably a better question for the publisher than for me, but follow me on Twitter and I'll tell you. I wish I had a Twitter right now. It's not just a shameless plug, but I don't know. I sort of was very involved in the design and then kind of said, cool, you do it. So I don't know a lot of those answers right now.
You just a big fan, or what's going on? Childhood favorite book, Moby Dick?
Melville is my favorite. Well, Moby Dick is my favorite book. Melville is great. If he hadn't written Moby Dick, Melville would be fine, in my opinion. Them's fighting words. A lot of lit crit scholars out there, I'm sure.
What about the book makes it the best book ever written?
Okay, this is my party game. I think there's like one or two exceptions, but I'll just say it without exceptions because that's more exciting.
Yeah.
Which is, you can relate anything, any like big sort of like top level literary theme is in Moby Dick, and I can make a convincing argument for it.
Mm-hmm.
And it's just like, it's the book about everything.
Right.
And it knows that it's the book about everything, and it just kind of is like, it's not a neat book. It's not an elegant book. It's just sort of like, here's the whole world in a book. And it manages to pull it off. It's great.
Yeah, I do love Moby Dick. It, to me, comes across as like a pessimistic Charles Dickens, which I like. I really dig that.
I feel like if Dickens were writing, if Melville were writing Dickens, it's like we would learn a lot more about how the poorhouses of London actually function.
Yeah,
we would get a whole chapter of like the monetary instruments that are in use and all that kind of stuff.
Well, it's like, to bring it back to the Tolkien thing, you know, if Tolkien were Dickens, then this is Melville being the George R. R. Martin of the world. You know, you actually explore how those sewers are working and the political intricacies. You know, it's not just Aragorn is king and, you know what, he's going to be a good king and everyone's happy. It's like, no, logistically, where did this guy learn how to balance the tax books?
Yeah. Yeah, so part of what turned me on to Moby Dick was, well, part of it was that I liked books, and I was a lit minor in college, and Moby Dick sort of was always on these great books lists, and I was like, oh, I'm never going to read that, it's so long. And so I took this semester away program at the Mystic Seaport Museum in Connecticut, which has the last remaining wooden whale ship, the Charles Morgan. She was actually built across the yard from the Acushnet that Melville sailed on when he was writing Moby Dick. Mm-hmm. All that's a long way to say he could have physically seen this boat with his own eyes. And I got to spend a semester living and working at this museum.
Dude, being on that awesome. Boat. Reading
Moby Dick. Yeah, it was great.
Oh, man, that's awesome. Yeah, I think Moby Dick was one of those things where, for me personally, you know, getting back to anecdotes, because this is my podcast, we're going to talk about me here. You know, I have some was is that my dad, he was never really into fantasy and sci-fi. He, you know, the Star Wars, the moment they start talking about the Force is a little too much for him, but he always had a kind of affection for Moby Dick and other kind of adventure novels from his childhood. Like he's a big fan of, let's say, like 20,000 Leagues Under the Sea, you know, that kind of stuff, kind of,
yeah,
pulpy.
It's like sci-fi. Moby Dick is like almost a fantasy novel. There's like the at the end where Captain Ahab's like super racistly depicted friends appear and they have,
yep,
like wizard powers and,
yep,
it's like, whoa, what is, like, this is not a realist novel anymore.
Right, right. Well, it was an epic novel, and that's the,
yeah,
the point of, I guess, convergence for me, is that I was very much into epic stuff as a kid and my dad wasn't, but he was into Moby Dick and he had that on his shelf. And I was like, this is the key to relating to my dad to things outside of rock and roll music. I have to read this book. So I think I have a particular memory of that book that I do love it. Can't say it's my absolute favorite, but still up there. A story that deserves its place in the annals of literary history.
You're here. I agree.
You mentioned, you know, what you majored in or minored in. You're a undergrad now, right?
I'm a graduate student. I'm a PhD student right now.
Oh, PhD student. Excuse me, sir. All right. So tell me about this. Like,
long road ahead.
Yeah. Teaching about, you're like a teacher or teacher's aide. What's going on?
Yeah. So, I'm in a communications and media program, and my work is studying non-digital games. So I'm still very early in my dissertation process. I don't really know how that will all shake out. But I've been given approval to write about the things that I love to do, which is awesome, and I'm very grateful.
That's
part of
incredible.
That trade-off is I work at the college where I study as a teacher, as a professor, and I assist other professors in their work of teaching and doing research. Yeah, it's great.
I think you should be hosting this podcast at this point. I mean, you're the professor, the board game professor at this point.
Not yet. There is a guy on Twitter called the Board Game Professor. I think he's actually a professor.
Yeah. Well,
there's a lot of us in higher learning in the academy. There are a lot of board gamers.
Okay. Well, until you fully become a PhD, I'm not going to refer to you as the esteemed title that I give to Dr. Reinar Knizia, but you know, you might be there someday, the good doctor of gaming.
Again, all these high flown comparisons, I feel like you're setting me up to fail. I cannot become Tolkien and Knizia, and there was another one too that I don't remember, but thank you.
Banksy,
right. That's pretty awesome. I think I would, of those three, I would go for Banksy first, although Knizia is pretty tempting.
That's a potent combination. but, you know, I've had Knizia on the podcast, and I've had you on the podcast, and I can't definitively say that I haven't had Banksy on the podcast. Because who knows? Maybe Banksy is actually Bruno Catala. For all I know, that could be the case.
Oh, man.
How good would that be?
That's, yeah, right.
So where from here? You finish up the carnival and you have a game on the horizon. Are you just going to continue creating ideas as they come up while you're also working on your PhD, or do you have like more structured plans in the future? Where are people going to see Greg Loring Albright?
in Philly mostly is where I hang out. If you want to see me, come to.
Well, I'm talking about your name, you know, printed on something. Where are people going to, like, get exposed to the things that you're doing? What's your 5-year plan here? What are people actually going to be consuming that you created? And how are you going to be affecting all the lives of all these young gamers out there, shaping their minds in what gaming can be?
Oh man, this is such a hard question you've set before me. The 5-year plan, what is the meaning of it all? I enrolled in a graduate program so that I would not have to answer these questions, because it could be up to a 7-year process. And right. Everyone in my program says absolutely don't take that long, but I was like, if I don't have to make life decisions for 7 years, I'll be happy.
Okay.
No, but that's fine. I do have an answer, which is that it's my hope, my sort of convergent work of both making and studying games, and sort of studying the making of games and making games that exist as like academic objects, or like games that can serve to aid learning. My hope is that people will realize that games can be powerful media to change the world. Sorry, I'm kind of stumbling over my words here. I had to write a recent grant proposal essay doing a lot of these things, and I'm trying to like sort out what I want to think. But what I'm trying to say is that games are really powerful and super interesting, and a lot of people in the board gaming hobby have learned this. That's why they're in the board gaming hobby. But a lot of people outside the hobby haven't figured out how to make the sort of like necessary time investment of like learning to play games pay off for them.
Right.
And so that's kind of my hope. I feel like games can make people more empathetic, or like in the case of pervasive games, can introduce people to a place that they thought was sort of totally worthless or totally dangerous. And pervasive games can say like, no, this place is beautiful and you can have these wonderful experiences here. And that's, you know, that's what games are for, in my opinion. And those are the kinds of games that I want to make.
What are your guiding principles? Like, are you doing this in order to educate the masses? Are you doing this just because you want to share your love of gaming? Is it that you are, like, convinced that you can be the forerunner of a whole new type of gaming that even in the realm of tabletop gaming or non-digital gaming is relatively unexplored? Or is it that you have even greater objectives out there? You were mentioning, know, change the world. You know, like, are there aspects of this that you're like, hey, you know, this could be useful in businesses, in nonprofits, that this could be a way that I could help people become more empathetic in larger social levels, governmental levels? You know, I work for the state of Alaska government, and anytime that there's an integration of activities or even games in order to help with empathy and understanding, you know, we mainly see small icebreaker type things, but even that has mm-hmm. the potential to really inform future conversations at an event. And I can't imagine someone who actually spends their day-to-day life focusing on this and saying, hey, for example, we have sovereign governments in these tribal entities here in the state of Alaska, and there's a huge diplomatic issue with the child welfare that's happening and the exchange between these citizens who are both citizens of the United States government and citizens of Tlingit culture, Haida, you know, all mm-hmm. these different governments. And how do we explore, you know, some of the concepts that we have to tackle from all ends through a platform that, you know, maybe gaming isn't the appropriate term for that. But is that something that you're even considering? Do you have those kind of aspirations? I don't know. I'm building you up again and again.
Yeah,
and you're like, geez, dude, this
happening.
Dude, just calm down.
This is like, this is to go with like a Tolkienian analogy. This is like, you keep like putting the One Ring out there and like, are you going to become the founder of a whole new type of gaming? And part of me is like, yes, of course. And the other part of me is like, no, like, don't get a big head. That's silly. Then no one person should have that much power, or I think can do that, realistically speaking. But where I think my work fits into all this, and you and the listeners can decide if this is me grasping the ring or casting it aside, is that I think that there is a sort of disconnect between the sort of like academic and maybe governmental and sort of more serious conception of what games are and the kind of insider gamer hobby person who knows what games can do, and that communicating across that boundary is a big part of my work. I gave a talk recently at my department's internal conference where I have a presentation I'm working on about Pandemic Legacy Season 1, and it just like blew people's minds. They were like, wait, you tear up the cards? And I was like, right? And like, this is like old news to you know, those of us who are creating and guesting on and listening to board gaming podcasts, but there are a lot of people who were like, I'm on Amazon right now, I'm buying it. And like, that's cool, and that's exciting. That's sort of the least important part of what I want to do, but I think that it grounds the more important part, which is that, like, changing, there are all these, trying to figure out what to say here. On one hand, I want to say that changing the world comes from changing people, and so that when you invest in people and, like, give people this sort of way to express their joy and, like, to play Pandemic Legacy for the first time, that is a net good. But then I also feel like changing the world comes from changing systems. And this is like a nice tie back to the Carnival de Resistance, which is a lot about changing your personal mindset, but thinking and learning about oppressive systems and how you may participate in them, even when you don't mean to. And so in that sense, changing the world is absolutely not about changing people, because you have to change these systems that make people think things that they don't even know that they're thinking. And games are good for that too, I think, because games encourage us all to be systems thinkers and to learn that, oh, well, in this game, I'm incentivized to do this, and so I'm going to do it. And I might not think about why. And that kind of learning is important in the real world, that there are lots of systems going on that we're not aware of that incentivize us to act in certain ways that might end up to us, you know, contributing to evil. And if we can become aware of those incentives and work against them, cool. And it doesn't make me personally evil that I'm participating in this system, but as soon as I become aware of it, I can start to reverse some of that stuff. So that was kind of a long answer to your question.
I had a very long question. That was probably half the time. Did I take
the ring and put it on my finger and try to become Sauron, or did I throw it aside?
I think that you, as Sam, held the ring. You were a bearer, and you willingly gave it up at the end, too. So I think you get the highest Tolkienian praise there.
Oh, you see, now this is, you just keep piling, being Sam Gamgee, that's like, and high praise again. Dr. Kanizia, Sam Gamgee, I just can't get away from it. Dear listeners, I'm not all these things that Jack is saying of me.
Well, you have hints of them, elements of them. You can aspire to model your life after them. And I just really want to see a fan fiction. Someone out there, please write the fan fiction in which at least Sam Gamgee is the Banksy of Middle Earth. Something is, there's a nut in there worth exploring.
Yep, I would 100% play that game.
Yeah,
you know what? Sam Gamgee, you have to make anti-Sauron graffiti all over the Shire.
You know what? I think there might be something in that. Kanizia can make that work. Kanizia can make that work. He doesn't need to follow the actual elements of the story. You know what, Fatty? He's bringing the ring along with the rest of the hobbits over to Mordor. Sure, fine.
That's a deep cut. That's Kanizia's Lord of the Rings co-op game. That's good.
Oh, dude. That's the best. I love that game.
Great game. Game a lot.
Yeah, for anyone who doesn't know, you know, think back to your favorite hobbits in the Lord of the Rings. You have Sam, Merry, Pippin, Frodo, and Fatty, and all of them accompanied the ring all the way to Mordor because we needed fifth player. All right, man, well, this is awesome. You know, the last thing that I wanted to hit on, because I do want to touch on, like, you as a gamer, as someone who makes games. You know, is there, like, for me, I had mentioned HeroQuest earlier, is there a game that really, as a child, made you think about gaming in a different way, other than the example you gave of your dad and making the treasure hunts for you, that kind of shaped who you are, your oeuvre, your essence?
Yeah, this is a kind of disappointing answer, but there's not really. I played a lot of Monopoly as a kid growing up, and my sister and I loved it because we are very close in age, and were very nice to each other, but also being very close in age, had a lot of like latent aggression that we needed to take out on each other. And so we could just wreck each other in Monopoly. And that was great fun. I do not have the negative feelings about Monopoly that a lot of people do, but I don't think playing Monopoly influenced any of my games or any of my work.
I don't know. You just examined Monopoly for its merits on what it allowed and empowered you and your sister to do rather than the structure of the game itself. So that kind of ties back into what we've been talking about.
Right. Player feeling as the metric.
Yeah. Without thinking about it, you were like, what is the outcome? Not, you know, how is it as a delivery device or a system, but you know, what is the outcome and the result of that? And did that meet our needs? And you know what? It did. It was perfect for you guys.
Yeah. That's a very charitable reading. That's good. I like that.
I try to see everyone in as best light as possible. All right. Well, if people want to learn more about Carnival de Resistance going on in Philly, first off, when are the event dates and where can people find out more so that way they can make sure to attend?
Yeah. So if you're in Philly, come out to the Carnival. So my summary earlier didn't include the residency portion, which is that there are a bunch of artists who are actually away at a training right now. And they'll be living on this eco village at the Norris Square Garden, which is up in North Philly near where I live. And all week, pretty much all day and all night, I think they'll be there doing garden tours and spinning fire and playing drums. And you can hang out with them when it's not during the performances. So that's the week between July 27th and August 4th. Anytime during that week, there are going to be things going on. And then the performances, the midway, the shows that I'm making these games for, will be happening on Friday, July 27th, Saturday, July 28th, Friday, August 3rd, Saturday, August 4th. The midway opens at 5. The show starts at 7. And anytime in that 2-hour window, you can come in and play the game that I made.
Awesome, dude. And what was the name of the Moby Dick game again?
Oh, yeah, totally. Leviathan. Well, first, let me finish. I forgot to do the important thing about the Carnival, which is CarnivalDeResistance.com or search Carnival de Resistance on Facebook. That's how you find it.
Perfect.
Great. I'm still learning how to do this promotional thing.
Me too. Leviathan. Me too.
Yeah, right. Leviathan is my Moby Dick themed micro game. It's 18 cards. It's tabletop card combat with some hidden movement elements. You can see it right now. You can see the awesome art from the artist Andrew Thompson at pastgo.net/Leviathan. Yeah, so any news about the game and its distribution, which I didn't have answers on earlier, will appear there.
All right, man. Well, it's a pleasure speaking with you, and I feel like, you know what, we're going to have to talk in like a year from now to actually touch base on how all this stuff is developed, and then hopefully have many more conversations in the future. It's been an absolute pleasure having you on the show, Greg.
Yeah, that sounds great. It's thanks for having me, and it's been a pleasure being here.
Thank you for listening to the Cardboard Herald. As always, everything we do is ad-free and audience-supported. If you'd like to help keep it that way, find the Patreon link at the top of our webpage, cardboardherald.com. We have several levels of support with various rewards. If you enjoyed the show, we do a whole bunch of other stuff, including reviews, interviews, and recommendations across writing, podcasts, and video. You can find that on our YouTube channel or by visiting any of our social media or our website. So with that out of the way, thank you again for listening to the Cardboard Herald.